Welcome to another episode of the Nui Tech People podcast. On this episode of the podcast, we've got Jackson Clark, director and CTO of Tentacle. Welcome, Jackson.
Thank you very much, James.
Mate, Tentacle, I came to know of you guys over the last couple of months. It's a really interesting story. So I was super excited to try and share the story of what are you doing at the moment and also your journey there. But for those of our listeners that don't know who you are, give people a bit of background on who is Jackson Clark to start with and then who is Tentacle.
Yeah, as James said, CTO and director at Tentacle currently, but grew up here in Newcastle. I did mathematics and physics at the University of Newcastle. That was in 07-09. At that time, I was deeply interested in theoretical physics and pursued that. The place to do that, it was the University of Melbourne. So I moved down there in 2010, actually lived on campus under a full scholarship, studied masters under Professor Ray Volkas in particle physics. And I was doing what's called particle physics phenomenology, which is an interesting space between theory and experiment. So it's making sense of the theory of new particles beyond the standard model particles to tell experiments where to look, and then also making sense of experiments to tell the theorists what implications the experiments have for their theories. So it's kind of sitting in the middle, straddling between the theory and the practical,
yeah,
which is sort of where I find myself in, you know, whatever I apply myself to.
Yeah.
And I sort of fell into that. I wasn't planning to do that for my master's.
Yeah.
But together with my supervisors, just sort of figured out that that's my natural place.
Yeah. What sort of jobs can you get on the back of that?
Well, you know, I wasn't thinking of jobs at the time.
No.
So I did my master's and then I actually came back for a year, finished off my master's degree, did a lot of tutoring, did some creative writing subjects, just wanted a chance to do something different and test myself in those areas, which, you know, really freed up my mind in preparation for a PhD, which I went back to Melbourne and completed. And yeah, more particle physics phenomenology, dark matter physics, Large Hadron Collider physics, early universe cosmology, really cool stuff. Got my hands a bit dirty with data, got my hands a bit dirty with coding, but nothing formal. And it was only at the end of that that I started thinking about jobs and what I wanted to do. And really the track is academia, postdocs, you do a couple around the world wherever you can, and then you cross your fingers that you can get back to Australia on a permanent basis. Something that in the end I decided that it wasn't something that I wanted to pursue because, you know, I just got married. My wife is pursuing a career in medicine. I was interested in lots of different things on the industry side. And it just so happened that, yeah, one of my mentors, Professor James Murray Parks, came to the physics building looking for physicists to hire in the engineering innovation space. Just as I was finishing up, and it was just the right timing, and I decided to go into that innovations group space, a small team, trying to apply fundamental thinking to innovations at that time in engineering construction.
Yeah, wow. Nice. Mate, we'll get into Tentacle in a second, but that's a really interesting path because I think there's a lot of people, if we're looking at younger listeners in particular, people that are going through the education system, somebody might be going through a university degree at the moment, maybe not know where their job lies at the end of it, or maybe continue down the academia route and then want to apply that to industry as opposed to continuing down the ongoing academia route. Would you have any advice to people? It sounds like you didn't go in there with the actual objective to jump, but rather the place you were at in your life suited going into industry as opposed to going internationally. Would you have any advice for people that are following that same journey at the moment?
Well, seeing a trend for physicists and mathematicians to be better appreciated in the data science space.
Yeah.
And that's obviously relevant to people who might be listening. At the time, my options were kind of, you know, before the innovations group came along, I was thinking one of the big consultancies they were hiring at the time, and they appreciate mathematicians, physicists, one of the big banks, you know, they're always looking for that kind of head, but it didn't excite me.
Yeah.
I wanted some variety. You know, I think there's more appreciation for it. You know, we went to the University Technology Day last week, you know, talked to a lot of students, some of them in maths or physics, most of them in computer science, data science, but also talking to the companies around the room, I think they can appreciate that kind of generic, general problem-solving approach.
Yeah,
can just be applied in so many industries, and that's what I've experienced in my time.
No, I completely agree. And I think with the changing jobs that are out there, like data scientists, roles that exist now didn't exist 10 years ago.
Yeah.
The ability to learn, the ability to problem solve and apply that to different verticals, it might be different industries, different type of jobs. I think that is probably the key learning. And I think that that's one of the commonalities between companies looking for, you know, top talent is those people who have a proven ability to actual problem solve. And it might be in a different vertical, but it's a transferable skill for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I've seen is, you know, when you approach things from a first principles basis, just use the fundamental laws of physics and logic and people, don't look at the rule book, you know. It's like shut that book that tells you how to do something and just think, okay, what is the business problem to be solved here? How might we attack it and get the right heads in the room who have, you know, knowledge in lots of different spaces? You can come up with new solutions, something that somebody trained in the field might not necessarily think of. And, you know, you pair that with people who are trained with the field, you come with a new idea and they say, okay.
That might work. That might not
work. That might work. And, you know, they can help to proof it or bring it into production. But, you know, those new ideas can come from people outside of the field or people who have worked in different verticals and bring ideas from those verticals into new verticals. I mean, that's how, you know, paradigms shift in science. That's how new ideas are born in, you know, general relativity, for example, came from a lot of knowledge that already existed in the mathematical space.
Yeah.
That was brought over and applied to the physical space. So working across verticals can really give you interesting and efficient solutions, and that's what I'm after.
Yeah, I also think it's one of the commonalities in the companies that I see really hire well is not looking for somebody that's been there, done that perfect role or done that before, but looking for the person that's got those transferable skills, because a fresh set of eyes sometimes, whether it be from a creative angle or just a general problem-solving angle, can be the biggest differentiator in coming out with any form of innovative solution, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one story that comes to mind recently, we were working with a large company who has hundreds of thousands of devices installed around Australia looking at their data. They were picking up some problems in the devices and they were trying to figure out what was going on. So we came on board to help them. We actually brought an analysis technique from the health industry, which we've worked in, called survival analysis. Typically, that's used in the health industry to study different cohorts of patients. So patients who might have received a treatment and patients who haven't received a treatment. And then you track those cohorts of patients until death. From that, you can generate a survival curve, probability of surviving after n many days. So 30 days, 60 days, 90 days.
Yeah.
We applied that in this space. We weren't looking at patients. We were looking at devices with particular components. And we weren't looking at deaths. We were looking at faults, you know, that were arising. And that technique just absolutely unlocked that problem.
Yeah, wow.
And made it very clear. And those plots that you can make, these survival curves, they're called Kaplan-Meier curves.
Yeah.
They make it extremely obvious what's going on and they communicate the problem really well to the stakeholders. It was just, you know, like a watershed moment when that data came through. And, you know, that only happens when you take an approach from one place and apply it elsewhere. Not to say that's never been done before, but, you know, it certainly wasn't something that was being thought about.
Yeah.
But once applied, just unlocked the problem. So, I mean, I can think of other examples, but that one is just part of our recent work that I really appreciate, that translation of idea between different spaces.
No, I like it. I was only having a conversation earlier this week with somebody in the education industry, and they're talking about their website and user acquisition type scenarios. And they're like, hey, as opposed to looking at other competitors in the same industry, they're looking at what is best practice in e-com and what's best practice in other online stores and what who does things well and how can we apply that to our industry as opposed to just looking within the same industry. Obviously, significantly different and lesser than, you know, what you're playing at the moment, but similar approach where looking at, hey, what can we take that's working somewhere else? How can we apply that to what we're doing? As opposed to just looking insular under what happens in our own industry or what's a way we've always done it ourselves.
You know, that just sparked in my head, user acquisition, time spent on the page until they leave, time spent on the page until they interact. That's survival analysis. You can think of it that way.
Yeah.
You could make those curves and, you know, be interesting to see what it looked like. But certainly that approach can be applied in that space as well.
Yeah, I love it. Mate, you've opened the door to the projects you're starting to work on under the Tenical company. Mate, for those of our listeners, and I'm assuming the vast majority of our listeners don't know who Tenical is. Mate, give us a bit of a backstory on who is Tenical. Let's start with who is Tenical and then your backstory. Later on, we'll get into some of the projects, but I find it a really interesting space, and it's a growing space at the moment, and there's more and more attention being given to the work that you're sort of doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So Tenical today is a data and predictions focused company. We've had a journey to get here. Originally, you know, I came out of uni in Melbourne, and that team eventually evolved into what it is today here in Newcastle. Now, that happened because in 2020, you know, just before COVID kicked off, unbeknownst to all of us, I decided I needed to come back to Newcastle for family reasons. Some of the team came up with me and we established a base in Redhead. So we've got a factory unit out in Redhead with some space for our servers and office space, a bit of a workshop area and a gym. You've seen our gym.
Yeah. I've also seen your servers that you built yourself.
Yeah, exactly. We can talk about that more.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we set up there in Redhead and we're now well established in Newcastle, and our vision is to have the core of the team in Newcastle.
Whilst playing on a global scale, right?
Exactly, yeah. So we want to really base in Newcastle and we have done work overseas. We want to do more of it. But, I mean, really, Newcastle is, it's a really good spot, in my opinion, for really talented people, and we've discovered more of them who are coming out of the University of Newcastle, for example, and don't necessarily want to go to Sydney or Melbourne. We can talk more about that. But in terms of what we're doing now, we're really based around two pillars. Those pillars are our Tenicals, hence the name. The Tenicals are our data ingestion modules. So we've built these to be extremely scalable. We've designed an interface, a protocol for them to communicate and run and be managed so that we can scrape data from literally anywhere. So we go out and we like to say, if you can see it on your screen, we can go and get it. So that can mean scraping the web, can mean hooking up with APIs, hooking up with spreadsheets, hooking up with other databases. But really it's about getting data and centralizing that data wherever it needs to be centralized. And that's really the first step in understanding the world around us, in our opinion, to make objective data-driven decisions. And then the other pillar is our engines. So these are our predictive engines. We've applied these in different industries, but essentially they're an approach, a first principles approach to predicting the future, understanding the now and predicting the future. So there's a case study on our website, for example, where we've applied one time series technique to commodities prices, and we've shown that these outperform model benchmarks and industry benchmarks. And our approach is called an ensemble method.
Yeah.
This method is known to be more accurate, has less variance than any other single model approach.
Yeah.
And essentially it's the idea of the wisdom of the crowd. So the more people in the room making a decision, you'll get a better decision than any of the single people in a room. So what we've built essentially is we've parallelized this and we've scaled it. So we've designed architecture so that we can send off requests for certain models to be run on certain pieces of data, put the results in a central place, collect them, and then optimize an ensemble that, you know, historically back-tested performs better than any of the single models that we ran in parallel.
Yeah.
That's our auto method that we now offer. just through our portal, and users can log on and trial that.
So users could log on, input their own data, and then use your engine. Is that right?
So currently, we manage the data sets.
Yep.
However, we offer a white label platform for our, you know, bigger customers.
Yep.
So that we can plug in their databases and they can run those engines on their own data.
Wow.
So at the moment, we're focusing on that value play. So low volume, high value. And, you know, we've talked about the opposite of that. So very high volume, lower value, so more retail customers coming in.
Yeah.
Something that we might build to in the future.
Wow. Interesting space. Obviously, the word AI gets thrown around a lot at the moment.
Yeah.
And bastardized versions of AI. What is AI?
Yeah.
Do you promote yourself as an AI company? Obviously, there's two sides to what you're doing at the moment, or two pillars, as you described it. Do you describe yourself as an AI company? Is that bastardizing, you know, who you are and what you do? Is it genuine AI? Where do you sit on the, you know, the current, I guess, market trends and commentary around AI?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, right? I mean, we could certainly call ourselves technical AI.
Yeah.
And maybe business would increase, I'm not sure. But we don't. We call ourselves technical CM&I.
Yeah.
CM&I is computing, machinery, and intelligence.
Yeah.
And that's actually the name of a paper by Alan Turing, very famous mathematician and computer scientist. We sort of named ourselves that as an homage to Alan Turing, but also as a bit of a differentiator, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, in my opinion, AI has its place, but it's a huge umbrella term. And
correct.
I don't pretend to understand every nook and cranny of it. Sometimes it's useful. But other times, you know, traditional statistical approaches are faster and more accurate and simpler. And in simplicity, I think comes a lot of power and robustness. So, you know, where I stand on it essentially is that, yeah, AI sometimes has its place and it's part of what we do, but I don't think it should be a starting point for solving predictive problems in data or otherwise.
Yeah.
We like to start simple and build up. So, you know, traditional regressions, linear regressions can be really effective and they're fast and they're understandable. And we've found in the past can blow AI methods, even machine learning methods, which are sort of in between, out of the water if you just get the data part right and the engineering of the data that goes into those models. So, yeah, I think the term definitely is becoming a little bit less meaningful.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think some people with a lack of knowledge would potentially consider your company an AI company. And as you said, you could probably throw a domain name at .ai after it. And, you know, it might change the way that, you know, you're viewed as well.
Mm.
But it's a really interesting space. And I think, you know, from the sound of things, like what you're actually doing can be applied to nearly any industry, right? So you could see any industry or any company with a decent data set is looking for to make some predictive analysis around what's going to happen in the future based on data in the past, you could potentially help. Is that how you're positioning yourself?
Yeah, exactly. So we want to be the world's number one prediction as a service provider.
Yeah.
That's our ambition.
Prediction as a service, I like it.
Exactly. So that's really based around that idea that we can service any industry, any vertical with common tools, common know-how, and deliver value. And that's really what we're about, delivering high value. I mean, really the recipe is the same, getting data, getting fresh data, making sure the pipeline between the update of that data and the update of any forecast or any insight that you're generating is minimized.
Yeah.
So when the unpredictable does happen, you are, you know, able to see the implications as soon as possible and make a decision.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't claim that you'll be able to predict everything. And anybody saying that you might be able to, I think, you know, we're a ways off that. You can't predict things like COVID coming along. You can't predict things like the invasion of Ukraine. You might be able to predict the probability of it happening, but exactly the timing, you know, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, black swan events, these are called.
Based on an event happening, you can use your prediction as a service to then look at potential outcomes off that and then make better decisions on the back of that. Is that sort of also how you can use it? Obviously, you can't predict every event, but once an event does happen, you can still use your service to then make better decisions based on that event happening.
Yeah, exactly. So that's exactly it. As long as you've got that, you know, that refresh time minimized, the latency, then as soon as something happens, you can react to it. And that's important. It's just making sure that companies have the data there to be agile when they need to be agile.
So you're quite a young company.
Yes.
I think prediction as a service, it sounds really beneficial to a lot of companies, a lot of industries. Do you have any early test cases, any early companies or industries you've been working in that would be, you know, a good early story to share?
Yeah, so probably a couple. One is in the commodity space. So as I mentioned, we've got a case study on the website where we look into it a little bit more in terms of the scalability of that ensemble approach. But we also offer a deeper sort of analysis, which we call our multivariate approach for particular series that we may want to predict. What that entails is bringing in drivers of a certain price or demand curve that we want to predict, and using the industry knowledge of our clients to understand what drivers are affecting this price or demand in the commodities industry, and building a predictive engine that has all of those drivers as inputs and then attempts to predict on the target variable, so the price or demand.
Wow.
So we've worked with companies to build these engines specifically for target series. And we've found that, well, first of all, that ensemble approach can beat already benchmarks in industry that exist and that are being used by these companies worldwide. But then, you know, as you bring in these additional data sources, you can measure what is affecting the price, what is a good predictor, and iteratively just improve on that accuracy. You know, there's obviously a lot of commodities companies making big decisions and spending millions and millions of dollars every day on these commodities, metals, agriculture commodities, soft and hard commodities. Any small accuracy that you can get on top of what others in the market have is hugely beneficial. So we've built those kind of models for companies, and you know, we continue to discuss with others where we might apply. Now, we always make sure that when we work with a client and we build a model for them, that client has, you know, sole use of that. We won't go and take that model and give it to their competitors.
Yep.
We want to service companies within a particular vertical in a way that's a good relationship, a partnership, and exclusive of others that work in the same vertical.
Beautiful.
So that's one. Another one that comes to mind is in the building industry. So buildings, energy kind of interface.
Yeah.
So hot topic at the moment, very hot, is carbon emissions and equivalent carbon emissions and getting to net zero.
Yeah.
So we believe that this problem is really a problem of bringing together, at least at the moment, disparate data. Somebody's going to have to do it. We're set up to do it. And we've worked with companies to do part of that. We'd like to do more. But one example is marrying up building energy data. So this is data about how much energy a building or a portfolio of buildings is consuming at any point of the day. And these are huge databases, like billions of rows in these kinds of databases. So marrying up that data with data from the Australian Energy Market Operator, that's public data, but they release it as CSV files. It's pretty hard to consume manually, almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But we've built connections, we've built tentacles to this data, and we bring it into a database, we can analyze it. That gives you information about the price of energy at any time of the day. It gives you information about the carbon mix. So you know at any point, as a function of location and time, how much solar, wind, gas, coal is in the grid.
Yeah.
And then the third piece that we've brought in is weather. So, of course, the biggest drivers of energy price and fuel mix is the weather.
Yeah.
You get those three pieces. You've got energy use. You've got the components of that energy. You've got the weather. All of a sudden, you can understand at any point of the day and the projections for the future, what is the equivalent carbon intensity?
Yeah.
You can understand how much, for every kilowatt hour I use right now, how much of that is clean,
yep.
How much of that is, you know, dirty.
Yeah.
And we've worked with companies to understand historically how they've performed and give advice on what they could change today to improve, not only like in terms of cost, but also in terms of making sure their carbon intensity equivalent is lowered. What's interesting in that space is that from day to day, and it depends which grid you're on,
yeah,
but from day to day, the equivalent carbon intensity can be twice or more. Like the differences can be huge.
Yeah, right.
So if you can schedule a plant to run, or you know, if you're a big energy consumer and you have some choices about when to schedule energy intraday or days out, which you can predict to some degree of accuracy, the weather days out,
yeah,
then you can really, really save on actual carbon used. And I think companies that really want to work to that net zero during that transition period where the grid does contain non-renewable energy, that's of huge interest, because you can make huge savings today just by shifting around your energy use.
Yeah.
And even if it doesn't show up in the official carbon accounting, where generally you're asked to make averages across your kilowatt hours used to the average fuel mix in the grid, the actual carbon intensity is very different.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I can see obviously multiple uses for, you know, where you guys play at the moment across multiple industries. I think that energy space, it's a no-brainer, right, for potential future growth for you as well.
Yeah, definitely. And we're looking to better understand that transition of all companies to net zero and help them understand really what are the changes that they can make today that will set them up to hit that net zero sooner.
Yeah, beautiful.
So there's various aspects of that, but really at the moment it's a disparate data problem. The data lives in so many different places, it's unclear.
Yeah.
You really need someone to come along who knows what it means to get data from different places and operate and maintain those connections when they go dark, and find new connections and advise on ones that are going to be stable and ones that look a bit iffy.
Yeah.
To just bring the data in to be analyzed in the first place.
Interesting problems.
Yeah.
Before we get into how you actually do that, for companies that hear this might find, hey, we've got a potential problem here, based on what Jackson and his team do, it could be an interesting, how do people find you?
So typically we've been found by word of mouth and networking.
Yeah.
So,
if people are looking for you, it's at
technicalcmi.com.
Yeah. We'll link that up in the show notes anyway, but I think it's an interesting point because I think there's multiple verticals, multiple industries that could potentially use, you know, your data set. Everyone's looking to become more accurate around their predictions around data. Everyone's looking for, you know, the little edge here and there. So I think it could be super interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So technicalcmi.com.
Yeah.
We're getting more inquiries every day through the website alone, more sort of cold calls, which is really good.
Beautiful.
Means a lot of meetings.
Yeah.
But that's positive.
Yeah, for sure. Mate, how this actually comes together. I've been to your offices and I've seen the servers you've built.
Yeah.
Talk to me through that. There's some meaning behind why you've gone about your approach as well. Obviously, over the past however many years, there's been a massive move to cloud computing. There's also been a massive move to, you know, using some of these bigger players and using their various tools. You've gone about building things yourself. Talk me through that approach on, you know, what that's looked like from the ground up and your reasonings behind it.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of arrived at it organically, but I think it has a lot of benefits, and I'll explain that. You know, historically we've got experience with enterprise grade servers.
Yeah.
To start with, and you know, setting up virtual machines and virtualization layers on those servers and running big crack units and so on. As we came up to Newcastle, we actually just discussed within ourselves, is that all necessary? And obviously cloud's an option, but for us, self-hosting, running on-prem, we learned a lot about what it means to run clustered environments, to build hardware, maintain that hardware, what it means to set up our hardware and software architecture on that hardware, that I think are really valuable for making the end product more efficient. So we did experiments where we took servers that were lying around and we networked them and deployed clustered databases, clustered orchestration layers so that we could run our microservices on those servers. And we found it to be really good. That kind of extended as needed. We needed additional nodes, additional compute, additional GPUs. So we added these. We named our clusters. They've each, you know, got a feel to us. Like personally, we feel attached. They have a look and feel. We know a bit of their ins and outs. Each of them have their own quirks. We know what they're strong at, what they're weak at. We know their physical specs because we built it. We literally built the nodes ourselves with our own hands, you know, bled for these computers and put them together and network them.
And is that still the route you take as you scale?
I think at some point, you know, it'll make sense to move some of our stuff to the cloud. But at this stage, we're doing really well just operating on-prem, and we're understanding the costs from a compute, memory, storage perspective without having to worry about getting a bill in the mail that you don't expect, which is really good for a group like us who, you know, work on new things and need to experiment. And interestingly, you know, we talked to the AI group at Stanford who had a very similar experience of going to the cloud and then actually withdrawing and coming back and operating their own in-house systems because students would accidentally rack up huge bills.
Yep.
Because they're just learning, you know. Having the ability to manage everything in-house just gives you that greater agility, flexibility, control. And also I just think that the learning experience is invaluable. I worry that if that isn't part of the curriculum or if you miss that step along your journey of being a data scientist or working in that space of cloud, then you really miss that hands-on what it means to run these things, which at the end of the day, someone's doing it. And someone's doing it for you. For me, when I go to cloud, I've got a lot of questions that maybe you wouldn't think to ask unless you've actually been through the experience and you've run these things yourself.
Yep.
And there's plenty of, you know, I met some students at the uni last week who are doing this. You know, they've set up clusters of GPUs in their garage, and that's great, but it's not necessarily taught.
Yeah.
There's definitely people out there who have never built a computer or set up a computer from scratch, who are, you know, using the cloud or advising on the cloud. And I just think that it's really valuable to have done that, at least for me. And I would encourage people out there who haven't done it before and work in the space to go and try it. And it's a lot of fun too.
Yeah. No, I think it's an interesting space. And I think it's in your space, obviously the cloud versus actually building something yourself. If you have a look at it from a software perspective, you're having a look at, you know, the rise of no-code tools and then also AI to be able to build, you know, basic level websites at the moment. And that will only increase as well with functionality over time. There'd be a very real difference between being able to spin something up through using no-code or AI as opposed to building something yourself and understanding the ins and outs behind it. I think there's a very different, obviously a very different approach, but understanding what goes in behind it gives you greater, I guess, power down, you know, to do more advanced features down the track, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's where our group has a big strength. You know, we've been through that process. I call it the fullest stack possible because, I mean, we don't build the hardware components, but we put them together.
Yeah.
We wire it all up. We run our own networking. We run our own databases. We deploy all our own containers. We build those containers. We continuous integration, continuous deploy, we manage our code, we build the front end, you know, we do all of that.
Yeah.
We understand how it all hangs together and interacts.
Genuine full stack.
Exactly. I think these no-code tools and tools that are available in the cloud, I think they're really good for getting you 80% of the way.
And for some people, that's all they need, right?
Yeah, and that's fine, you know, absolutely. Sometimes that's all you need. But for that last 20%, which can be really valuable for, or really important for people, really valuable to big companies, that last 20% that can give you an edge, that's where we can come in and we have an understanding of how to chip away at that last 20% where you might not have the option if you went for one of the integrations because they've, you know, they've abstracted all of that away.
Yeah,
we find that may take a little bit more time, but once you crack through it, you crack through that 80% and you're up at 90%, 95%, and you're chipping away at that 100% until, you know, the business case doesn't make sense anymore. which is fine. Your inputs are greater than your outputs, and then you move on to the next problem.
Yeah. I think it'd be really interesting to see how that plays out for you over time and, you know, whether you carve off some sections of that to, you know, put in the cloud or some parts that, hey, it doesn't make sense for us to actually, you know, build and host ourselves while still owning the, you know, the part that is your big differentiator, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's a journey for a lot of companies go through, right? But actually understanding your company inside out from the ground up gives you a really good starting point of which to build upon. And then you know what works, what doesn't, and you can really make great decisions around what is a better option for your company going forward, right?
Yeah. And I have a prediction for you. And that is a lot of the companies that are, you know, currently transitioning or have transitioned to cloud, I think over time they will find that there is a place for on-prem.
Yep.
At least some of it will, you know, be clawed back. And I guess you just hope that by that time you haven't lost the internal knowledge that existed, because everyone did on-prem, you know, that was the way to do it.
Yeah.
A decade, two decades ago. And that knowledge is slowly being lost, and the cloud is consuming all of that. And it works in many cases, but not all.
And is that your reason for your prediction is the lack of knowledge, or the greater knowledge that you'd have in-house?
The reason for my prediction on that is my own experience and our own experience in, you know, going some way toward that and then realizing that there is more to learn and more to be explored in doing things efficiently in-house. And the on-flow effects of that is that you really are thinking about, how do I make the most of what I've got?
Yep.
What's the sort of minimal required to get where I want to go, rather than buying into something that you can grow into or might be too big or has too many features that you don't really need and will just kind of slow you down if you aren't careful.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting space, right? And I think it's a horses for courses type situation as well. Nowhere near as technical as you, but I'm just looking at it from a talent perspective as well. You've obviously got that capability in-house. Some companies don't have that capability or the skill sets in-house to be able to do it. Mm. And then you get that, you know, cost-benefit ratios, and you have, I got to hire somebody with those skill sets to actually do that. And then you're looking at that. So I think it's one of those situations where, as you said, for some companies it'll make a, you know, a lot of sense to bring it back in-house or to keep it in-house if you've got it on-prem. Versus others would just, you know, it'll be a cloud story forever for them, because it's a bit of a nearly a set and forget, and then hope you don't get the big bill in the mail.
Yeah, that's it.
It's an interesting space. It's good to have, you know, both the options there, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, not only that, our mathematicians and physicists, they really enjoy that because they want to understand, they want to dig deep and understand what's going on. They don't want to just use a tool to get an outcome.
Yeah.
They want to understand what's going on inside that tool. I mean, we hire really bright minds. We're always on the lookout for those minds, wherever they might live. Typically, we found them in science, but they exist everywhere.
And do you think, I'm going to just dig into that for a second.
Yeah.
The rise in data science roles is massive, right? Predictive analysis, prediction as a service, like I think it's going to continue to be a growing space. Mm. The best path into that as a career, I think you've mentioned multiple different things. It's, you know, the problem solving is the core of it, but it could be maths, it could be physics. There are people obviously going through and just doing straight data science degrees now. Do you have thoughts around that? Is there one that sits above others, or is it just the right person, no matter, you know, which different avenue they've taken?
Mm. I mean, one disadvantage of hiring a mathematician or a physicist is usually they've got some experience coding with data, but it's not formalized. You know, they need to learn that on the job. And what we found is they can learn it, and they can learn it quickly. And when they do learn it, they can really master it, become very good at it very quickly. So there's that kind of time that you have to, you know, teach, and we're very willing to teach good people, smart people. Now, I think it doesn't matter whether you're coming from mathematics, physics, data science. I think what's important is that you do well, and in doing well, that's an outcome of really understanding the subject matter and really wanting to excel in the solutions that you're working on. You're looking for people who achieve well at university, but really kind of take that next step to understand at a deeper level what's going on. And I think that's the key, you know, whether you are trained in physics and maths, which are at that more fundamental level, or you're doing straight data science, understand at a more deeper level what's going on. Don't settle for just using the tool to get an outcome. And there'll be people in data science that are wanting to do that and that do it and just do it naturally. They're the kind of people that we look for.
Yeah, as you said, I think with the rise in fantastic tools out there as well, some people could consider themselves a data scientist without actually understanding, you know, the nuts and bolts behind it or what's actually going on, but just putting a tool, writing some script to sit on top of some data, and you can get an outcome without genuinely understanding the problem or be able to put more predictions around that.
Yeah, well, that's the danger, right? Because getting it 80% of the way can sometimes be easy, but it can also be dangerous, yeah, because that last 20%, I mean, therein lies the weeds. That's the bit that I love. But in the weeds, that's the important bit.
It's also the value, right? Because like if you're talking, you're working with companies where you're making predictions around, you know, small percentage changes being worth millions of dollars. So, you know, you're getting 80% of the way there. Are you getting it 92% or 94% of the way there? 94, that 2% difference can be mean the difference of millions of dollars, I imagine, for the companies that you'll be working with now and then in the future, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is the differentiator, and that's the value add for a company like yourself, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would definitely encourage, you know, dig deeper and understand what's going on and see if you can do better with simpler tools. And that's really a challenge to yourself. Like, how far can I push the simple thing until I've reached the ceiling before I move on to the more complex thing? And understanding where the ceilings lie at each point tell you the return on investment, because the simpler things are less investment, both to develop, but also to operate and maintain. And the really big AI-based solutions, they're going to be expensive to run in the future. And we have to start asking questions about whether our society wants to consume that much energy on some problems that may be quick to just throw an AI or ML tool at it and get a good solution, but is it efficient computationally when there are much simpler, just traditional statistical methods out there that that can run at much less the cost, but give you potentially more accurate outcomes?
I like it. Just from an advice piece, so if somebody is looking to join a company like yourselves, or even if it's not join your company, but looking to get in and around prediction, has an interest in machine learning or AI, and really understanding, like, you've gone through the academic avenue, but you've also mentioned that you've had people in your team that have had to learn to code non-traditionally, and, you know, whether that be online or just learning from others. Now, if you had to give some people some best practices or advice from your experience and the people that you've worked with, is there some no-brainers that you would say, definitely do this? There obviously there's multiple avenues to get to either your team or to be successful in this space, but is there some no-brainers that you would say, hey, I'd definitely invest my time in XYZ?
I mean, for me, what I look for is genuine interest and initiative. So not just ticking the boxes or going through the motions. Somebody who's actually gone out there and done stuff. So that could be in the form of, you know, going and investing in building your own cluster. You can get secondhand stuff to do that relatively cheaply and really cut your teeth on what it means to run a database that is redundant, run containerized services across multiple nodes and load balance those and expose them to the internet and pay maybe for a virtual machine where you host a website, things that are real and you can put in your, you know, portfolio to exhibit what you've done, but just tell the story and be able to say with hand on heart, I know these things because I've done them, not I know how to do it in theory.
I love that. I think there's a lot to learn by doing as opposed to book smarts, right? Like that learn by doing, it's the same with a website. If somebody's looking for a software engineering role, doesn't have a great deal of experience, but they've built something for themselves. It's showing that you've had the ability to learn and the ability to turn those learnings into an actual outcome, right? I think for me as well, in the recruiting space as well, having a look at people that have shown that initiative to go out there and do that on their own shows, again, that real interest in it. And if they have interest, if they've got a genuine interest in it, I always find that those people tend to succeed longer term, because we all face challenges in our role. We'll have great days and we'll have ordinary days. But if you've got that genuine interest, it allows you to fight through those problems that are a little bit harder, or the challenging days, or, you know, the times where you're working on a project that might not be as sexy as some of the others. I think that's fantastic advice.
Yeah, I think you need a genuine interest to survive and stay sane. I had some friends going through PhD who had a real hard time, but I loved it because I loved what I was studying. And today in my job, yeah, there are days where you're doing stuff you don't really want to do.
Yeah.
But there's lots of aspects that I would do in my spare time and sometimes do. You know, I can't do too much because you need to do other things. So I go out and go for a run or play soccer,
yeah,
spend time with the family. But yeah, having a genuine passion and interest and feeling compelled to do at least some of what you do every day, you should be latching onto that.
Yeah, I think that's how you continually get better, right? You continually learn, and you're doing that after hours because you have a genuine interest in it. You mentioned the family and the health part there as well.
Mm.
Something I'm super interested in. You're obviously super technical, but you're also directors of your company. You mentioned you're taking multiple phone calls at the moment from companies inquiring about your services. So you're not only technical, but you're looking at the business development part, and you're playing in there as well. And then you're trying to manage family and health as well. How do you manage those three buckets? If you look at health, family, work.
Well, I mean, on the health side, funny story. I actually had a health scare earlier this year where I ended up in hospital with viral meningitis. You know, I'm told completely random, can just hit anybody. And I'm maybe not the best person to talk to about managing health, because there I was once after a few days in hospital, I felt good again. I still had to be on the antivirals.
Yeah.
But I was doing work because, you know, I couldn't sit still. I had to do something and I was trapped in a room. I'm all recovered from that. But essentially, I just try to work to first my responsibilities, make sure I'm fulfilling those from a family side, and just keep active and healthy because it's good for my mind. So I used to ride a lot, ride my bike. I don't do that so much anymore because the time investment is bigger than running. So I'm just running, and I run long distance. I did some ultra marathons and training for Sydney Marathon. That keeps me sane. But in my work life, I think for me, the key is to only take the things on that I'm naturally best inclined and good at, and the other bits to share amongst the team. It's really a team effort, and understanding who in the team is best placed and like has the mindset for certain tasks, and to help each other out when needed. Because I have a tendency just to work really hard and do things that I'm not necessarily inclined mentally to do, and then sort of start to burn out. But I always put my hand up and say, hey, team, you know, I'm feeling the burn of doing this.
Yep.
Can I have a day to do my other stuff and somebody take it?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, sure. And then we just share that. And importantly, you know, we've had a new CEO come on board, Davi LaFerla. He's taken a lot of that commercial side away. And I'm partaking in most meetings, but not having to set them up and continue the communication or be part of the early meetings.
So play stronger from the technical side, which is your strengths.
Exactly.
Yeah, I like this. There's a couple of points you made mention there. That part where you're doubling down on your strengths. So you're playing to your strengths, and you're using your team to actually play on the parts where you don't get as much energy, or potentially they can do and it's not as high valuable.
Yeah.
Of your time, like if you've got a particular skill set, obviously as one of the founders, probably one of the most technical in the team and have strongest knowledge around particular areas. So doubling down and playing where, you know, your time is most valuable, and then spreading out the responsibilities that, you know, other people can come in and help with.
Yeah. I mean, you'd know, like when you've been in the business for a long time, you set it up, you know, all the ins and outs and how it works, which means that in principle, you can operate anywhere.
Yeah.
You can do anything, which is a strength, but also a potential weakness if you don't manage that.
Yeah.
So you need to make sure that, and always thinking is my time best spent here or somewhere else? Sometimes you've got no choice and you've just got to do what you've got to do on the day. But we have a meeting every morning. I guess you could call it a stand-up. We never called it that. We just have our morning meeting just naturally every morning.
Yeah.
We review everything that we're doing. We report on what we did the day before and we just reallocate, you know, what do we need to get done today? Are we on track for hitting our goals for the week?
Mm-hmm.
It's formal, but also informal.
Yeah.
That's our time. That's the golden time. We don't schedule any meetings over that if it can be helped. Just to everyone get on the same page and make sure that we are in the place that we need to be to inch forward as far as we could inch forward that day. We're kind of self-optimizing, self-correcting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little self-correcting algorithm every day.
No, I like it. I like it. It's a good productivity tool as well, right? To just keep checking what am I achieving each day and then a bit of retrospect as well. And how did I perform yesterday? And, you know, some days will be better than others, but it's good to be aware of that either way.
Yeah. We try to keep it to half an hour. Sometimes it's an hour or more.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of time to dedicate, a lot of resources.
But 100%.
We used to do just a Monday meeting and then, you know, you're off for the week.
Yeah.
Go do your thing. But sometimes somebody misinterprets on the Monday or...
A week's a long time.
Things change, right? And then the next week, you've potentially wasted a week. So
yeah.
Of potentially multiple resources.
Yeah.
So just, you know, I think it's time well spent. We couldn't think of working any way differently anymore.
No, I like it, mate. Like at the other point you mentioned before, which I would just want to come back on, the work-life balance part.
Yeah.
Do you think work-life balance is a thing? Do you think you can be successful in building a company the way you are, having work-life balance in the way it's viewed? Well, again, I'll actually ask you on what your version of what does that mean and do you think it's possible?
Yeah, good question. A friend of mine years ago, he said to me, you know, do you live to work or do you work to live? And I was like, I thought to myself, what is the best?
Mm-hmm.
And he was very proud to say that he works to live, you know, goes to work to live the life that he wants to live. And I was like, I don't think that's a good answer, to me at least. Like I think living to work is only bad if you hate your work.
I agree.
So I was like, I think I live to work. Like I want
to
work.
And working to live, if you hate work, is a terrible outcome also. Because if you have a look at purely from a ratio perspective of having a look at a week, 5 days out of your seven, you're spending doing something you hate to enjoy the other two. So for five, spend doing something you don't like to do with a bit of oversight, you know, mornings and afternoons or whatever, or mornings and evenings, you can do what you like.
Mm.
But to do something you hate for 5 days a week, just so you can enjoy 2 days a week, is a ratio that just blows my mind.
Yeah. And like, I'm not saying he hated his work, but to me, living to work would be a great outcome because if you live to do the thing that you spend most of your days doing every week, and that was part of what drove or what drives you every day to get up in the morning, I think that's really great. And it shouldn't be that it feels like that's squeezing out other things that you want to do in your life.
Yeah.
It's just about finding that balance. And, you know, for me, I need to make sure that it doesn't squeeze out family time or time that I need to dedicate to keeping healthy and keeping my mind fresh. But the things that I do in my personal life are also helping my work life.
Yeah.
Because they do keep me fresh and they allow me to have new ideas that I wouldn't have if I just went, you know, all in on work.
Yeah. I like it. Part that you talk about there is like finding something meaningful in work or finding a connection between what you do day in, day out and who you are, who you genuinely are and what you want to be as a person. I don't think you have to love work, right? Especially like it's a little bit different being a business owner because it's something that's obviously a passion of yours. But I don't think every employee out there has to love work. But I feel like to be successful, you want to feel like some form of connection between who you are and what you're actually doing.
Yeah.
Or some form of meaning in actually what you do day in, day out to be truly successful.
Yeah. I think, you know, you should love some aspect of your work.
I agree.
And if you don't, then that would be a shame. And you should think about what you can change.
Especially in the technology space. I think like anyone that you're talking to in your space, if you got really strong skills from a scientific perspective or a data science perspective, you shouldn't be without options for work. There should be multiple companies out there that are looking to hire people with your skill set, or you add a secondary or a third skill set on top of yours and skill stack, and if you do that, you'll open up more opportunities for yourself and hopefully something that you actually do get some enjoyment out of.
Mm. And there's lots of different aspects to it.
Yeah.
It's not just the deeply technical data stuff that's important. You know, for me, what's important is using that and the power that you can get from that to actually help people.
Solve problems.
And solve problems. And there's the people aspect, right? And you've got different people in this space that like different ends of that spectrum. People who really want to work closely with the client, have personal relationships and excel at that and enjoy that. Then you've got people who would rather have as little of that as possible and just get down in the weeds and work there and look at logs, look at numbers, optimize algorithms. There's a place for both. I span across all of it. I enjoy all of it. But what's important, I guess, is that there's a place for different kinds of people, even in data science, which you might think, well, it's pretty geeky, pretty nerdy data, but data science means nothing unless it's applied to real problems, real people who have real feelings and want to do better. So it needs to be communicated, it needs to be applied, it needs to have genuine impact on people's lives.
No, I love that. I think that's a pretty tight way to finish the podcast today. But for those of our listeners who might have an interest in what your company does, either to join your company as an employee, if they've got skill sets around this sounds super interesting to them, or you're a company and you've got a real world problem that you think Tentacl might be able to solve or help with, how do people get it best in touch with you?
Yeah, just go to our website, tentaclcmi.com.
Yeah.
Or Google us. And there's a contact form.
Yeah.
Fill it out and get in contact and it'll go to my inbox and a few others in the group, and we'll get back to you pretty quickly.
Beautiful. Mate, appreciate your time today.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks, James.